Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. These are the Dhamma Talks and Sangha Discussions from our 2017 Spring Retreat at One Dharma Center. These talks developed a core understanding of the Buddha's Dhamma, dependent origination, Four Noble Truths, the Three Marks of Existence, Five Clinging Aggregates, and Emptiness. Three key suttas that we focused on are the first three suttas presented by the Buddha upon his awakening. As will be shown, our retreats are not silent retreats. For a few days, we take retreat from the world, but certainly not from the Dhamma. There is no forced silence or other forms of asceticism on our retreats. We engage wholeheartedly with right speech and the other seven factors of the Eightfold Path as the framework for our retreats. An always remarkable aspect of our retreats is a gentle but well-focused engagement with the Dhamma from our entire retreat Sangha. This gentleness and lightheartedness is evident from the frequent laughter that occurs in our Dhamma sessions. Thank you to all who brought their mindful presence in support of each other, and a special thanks to Maura for her early morning meditation and guidance to all, and to Matt for the skillful Qigong sessions throughout our retreat that refreshed mind and body and brought great awareness to what was occurring. I hope you find benefit from these talks. Peace. So the Nagara Sutta, this is, I won't get into the whole introduction to this that's in your book. Oh, just about the book that you have there, that is a proof copy. The reason why it's a proof copy and not a fully published copy is I wasn't sure I could get them shipped to me on time for the retreat, and I wanted to have them. So there's still some grammatical errors and a few contextual things that I think in the beginning of the little bit about the Third Noble Truth, it says something like human league possible instead of humanly possible. That's the auto correction. Yeah. but it's, you know, it's basically the book. The published book, the chapter on, what is the chapter called? Modern Buddhism, the Thicket of Views. That's not in the published book. But the new article on the Pali Canon is, and the last chapter is on the Kalama Sutta. As soon as I get the next shipment of the published books, I'll have them at the center, and you'll all get another copy like that. I would like to ask everyone, if you want, thinking about it, to please go on Amazon and give a review. I would greatly appreciate it, as long as it's a good review. If you got something bad to say,
congratulations on your new book.
Ah, thank you. Since you said, I really am pleased with it. It's been a long time coming, and you'll experience it in this retreat. I think the book really presents the most important teachings in the right context and in a few different contexts. You'll see that the five clinging aggregates and dependent origination are talked about in two or three different contexts, and it's really important to see them that way, I think. So thank you. I'm pleased with it. How I see better now. So I can't tell how. Sometimes my eyes are better with the glasses and sometimes not, so the glasses are off. Where do I want to start? Here's a good place to start here. This is about a quarter of the way into that chapter, where the Buddha's. So the whole sutta is about the Buddha describing the process that he went through in his awakening. And this is, now he's describing himself, and he often described himself when he was talking about the quality of his mind before he was awakened. I can't talk to you when I can't see you.
Did you want me to turn the light and see if that works?
No, it's just the way it is. I'm okay. It won't make any difference. The Kindle is lit, so.
Do you want us to move closer?
No, everybody's fine. Everybody's fine. We're good.
Just sit right here.
That's pretty good. What was that sign? We're fine.
If you get darker, I won't be able to see you. Oh.
I'll talk quick. One of the things that I noticed this last year. One of the things that are, again, it sounds like I'm putting other things down. I'm really not.
I so appreciate that we laugh a lot on our retreats too. I mean, you know, they say, why? I mean, this is incredible that we're here and we're able to experience it. It should be joyful. We should be laughing a lot, and we shouldn't be taking any of this too seriously. Except it's the most serious thing we can do. So, the Buddha often described himself before he awakened as an unawakened bodhisattva or bodhisattva, and the reason why he was using those terms is he was describing himself with the quality of mind of an incredibly compassionate human being, but he was still lacking understanding of Four Noble Truths. And that's the distinction. Helen.
Can I ask a favor?
Sure.
When you use a Pali word, can you give the English translation for it?
Oh, of course. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Bodhi means awakened mind, and Sattva is a tough one. Sattva would refer to an awakened being, so it's almost saying an awakened mind, awakened being married together. What it really refers to is as a bodhisattva in the Mahayana path. Is someone who has accepted that role as the bodhisattva. In other words, that's your path to develop awakening. I took the vow of the bodhisattva during a really nice ceremony quite a few years ago now. But it's a different path than the Buddha taught. Again, I'm not putting it down. I always got to give that disclaimer. But it means that you are now someone who has decided to seek awakening for the benefit of all sentient beings, meaning that once you awaken, then you can awaken all others. And it took me a while to realize that. If the Buddha was an awakened being, how come we're not all awakened now? Because he did it. He achieved the goal. Sometimes it's presented this way, that I'm going to delay my own awakening until all other sentient beings are awakened. And, of course, that also contradicts the Buddha's path. But it also, when you listen to what the Buddha talks about in this sutta, you'll understand what he's saying when he says, I was an unawakened bodhisattva. He hadn't quite gotten there yet. But you're describing the quality of a very compassionate human being. So did I answer your question?
Yes.
Okay.
So
thank you for the question.
Bodhisattva would describe an awakened being.
No, that's what the translation is. The Mahayana translation is that. What the Buddha's describing is using the word bodhi is having a highly developed mind. Deeply in that case, sattva means as a human being, understanding the human being, having great compassion, but still lacking the understanding that he would achieve shortly.
Okay, so through an understanding. Bodhisattva is not the goal.
Not when the Buddha is using the word.
Okay.
So it's in the chapter on the Pali Canon and the talks I just gave it the difference. And the reason why it was substituted between the second and third Buddhist council is obvious, because there was a need to substitute a path other than the Buddha, and I won't get into that talk tonight. Mm-hmm. If there's time, maybe I will talk more about it. So again, the Buddha understood, getting a little bit off track, there's a series of stories called the Jataka Tales, J-A-T-A-K-A, and they're purportedly the stories of the Buddha's previous lifetimes before he had awakened. And they're really interesting stories. I see them as fables used to describe the development of a human being from prior to being a bodhisattva, to being a bodhisattva, to then awakening. So just an example of one of the stories is the Buddha in a previous life noticed that a tiger was malnourished and there was no food around and couldn't feed the tiger's own children, cubs? The tiger's own cubs. And so the Buddha in a previous lifetime went and gave his body to the lion, to the tiger, whatever it was, so that the tiger could gain strength and feed its cubs. Again, it's a beautiful story, and it does describe great compassion, doesn't it? So in that way, the Jataka tales are useful in describing something like that. But again, the Buddha here is describing himself as a bodhisattva prior to his awakening, and that leads to what the...
Can I ask one?
Sure, question? Of course.
So, that'll be laboring the point. Not to go because I'm not interested in the Mahayana, you know, kind of re-looking at that. But so literally, a bodhisattva would be an awakened being, an awakened mind being, right?
Oh no, the words translate to that, but there's two different applications of this, of the word. Bodhisattva in the Mahayana lexicon means someone who is developing that awakening. Helen asked me what the words actually mean.
Right.
So you could say that the words are describing what you might be aspiring to in the Mahayana tradition, but the Buddha is using the words to describe himself prior to his awakening. I don't know how to explain it any better than that. It's quite confusing, but...
As I said, I was not talking about the Mahayana aspect. And as you know, and as we know, that these are translated words, you know, and translated texts. So I think, the whole authentication of the Pali Canon, your talk on that, phenomenal, right? Sometimes when I hear these translations, they're translations of translations, mm-hmm. right? So, mm-hmm. you know, somebody might have translated. So I'm being nitpicky. I understand the subtle point of he's referring to himself as someone who is aspiring awakening. He is a sentient being who is aspiring awakening. But so it sounds almost paradoxical to say an unawakened bodhisattva, an unawakened awakened being.
But how else could he describe himself, though?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I guess there is no other way of saying it. Right?
Let me try to make it clear this way. He's describing himself mm-hmm. as someone who is highly evolved. As he take the two words separately, Bodhi is awakened. Mm-hmm. Sata can be, in that sense, can be almost there. So he's nearly an awakened human being. You could say that Sata is like saying pre-awakened. So he's saying the same thing twice. I'm an unawakened human being, only to describe that he is a deep. He's saying I'm a very compassionate man. I have all the qualities of an awakened human being except one. I don't understand the true nature of dukkha.
So can I be a really cranky...
Yeah, but I don't want to get too far into this, but okay.
So just why like, you know, say it refers to a compassionate being when there isn't necessarily anything in a bodhisattva that is necessarily the... let's just drop that one. So I'd say it's more that it's an awakened being that's almost fully awakened. So just missing the awareness and deeper penetration of the understanding of the basis of ignorance.
That's really the best way to look at it, and that's all of it. I get caught up in the words too. I'm not saying that's sometimes the problem with these different interpretations. So you have to look at the context and what he's saying. It used to be years ago you could call a plumber a carpenter because it was all the same thing. Today, when you say the word bodhisattva, it has a different meaning than when the Buddha used the word because of the adaptations that have made it and the different context. So the Buddha is giving us the context by using the word, I am an unawakened bodhisattva. That's the context. So let me read this and maybe it'll become even more clear.
The sutta itself is perfect, so we shouldn't be sticking on.
Here's how I probably should have just read this. So, monks, prior to my awakening, when I was an unawakened bodhisattva, and he actually describes this pretty good, I should have just read it. I thought I could continue to divide my thinking. I continued thinking intended on sensuality, ill will, and harmfulness, and thinking intended on renunciation, goodwill, and harmlessness. That's the perfect explanation of a bodhisattva. He was of two minds. There was a part of him that was highly evolved and was harmless and was compassionate. But lacking complete understanding, he still had elements of ill will. And he's describing that in his own mind. And now when I get into the Nikara Sutta and how he really explains that in relation to dependent origination, he talks about the feedback between name and form, identity as a physical form, giving it a individual quality, and consciousness, and how that becomes a feedback loop. He's describing that here too. I'm an unawakened bodhisattva. I'm highly evolved. I want to be compassionate. I want to serve humanity. But he's also admitting to himself, because I understand the way I'm thinking, that I still have ill will, that I still have some elements of harmfulness. I'm split. I can't be awakened if I'm thinking that way. I'm an unawakened bodhisattva. I have the inner wherewithal and the inner drive to be awakened. But I'm still unawakened. Yeah. Why? Because I recognize the disturbing qualities of my own mind. I'm lacking complete understanding. And again, this will put it all into context. So notice here the Buddha is describing precisely what happens when a goal other than developing the Eightfold Path and ending the conditioned thinking that caused conditioned thinking, I know that even sounds like a feedback loop, but that'll be clear, can be both harmful and altruistic simultaneously. The best example I can give, because it's such a grotesque example, are the Christian Crusades. They did abominable things to other people, but they believed that they were being highly altruistic, that it was okay to do this because they had other people's best interests in mind. They just didn't. I mean, it's a pretty extreme example, but they just didn't understand how to do it. They were trying to save people by sometimes killing them. But it's just a perfect example of that split mind of having deep compassion, but not having the wisdom to apply that compassion in a useful way. This can occur continually in a mind that is ignorant of four truths. This continually distracting feedback loop is explained in the sutta. The Buddha continues, as I remain mindful and well concentrated, thinking with the intention of clinging arose in me. I now recognize that thinking with the intention of clinging has arisen in me. He's now starting, his mind has developed a deep enough level of concentration, just like we're doing in meditation, in the right framework. He's starting to recognize the qualities that are necessary for awakening. He's recognizing clinging. I now recognize that thinking with the intention of clinging has arisen in me. Thinking with the intention of clinging brings suffering for me and others. He's recognizing everything that we talk about. Why do we develop concentration within the framework of the Eightfold Path? So we can recognize clinging. And here the Buddha is describing exactly the same thing that we do. He's telling us why he presented an Eightfold Path. This conditioned thinking, condition is the word that I put in there. I'll read it his way. This thinking can only lead to more ignorance and does not develop unbinding from clinging to wrong views. As I noticed that wrong intention developed more suffering, wrong intention subsided. He just had to become familiar with his own thought process. Again, the framework of the Eightfold Path is what provides that. Subsequently, when wrong intention arose in me, I simply abandoned it. Do you see the process he's describing? And it's simply recognizing what's going on in his own mind. But just a few paragraphs ago, he didn't have that clear understanding of what was occurring in his mind. He was of two minds. He was of that split mind. Now he's starting to see things clearly. He's describing his own process of awakening. This is my personal account of this. And this is quite a few years ago now that I read this. When I first read the Nagara Sutta many years ago, it was the guidance I needed to look closely at my recently taken bodhisattva vows in a Tibetan Buddhist tradition and finally understand the confusing uneasiness I had over those vows. And immediately, even during that whole weekend, I didn't understand why, but it didn't feel right to me. And it was because I was exaggerating now this feedback loop that was in my own mind. Because I was taking a what to me was a very solemn vow to be a highly compassionate human being 100% of the time when I didn't have it in me yet. I was of split mind. It was my intention, but I did not have an understanding of the Four Noble Truths yet to carry through on my vow. I began to realize that the path the Buddha taught was not founded in a bodhisattva ideal, but ending in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. This single realization changed the entire direction of my Dhamma practice and my life. I ended clinging self-identification to the bodhisattva vow and began wholehearted engagement with the Eightfold Path. So in the Nagara Sutta, when the Buddha is referring to the world, that's metaphor for the ongoing struggle with dukkha. Just like we've done that with our intentional engagement with a retreat. We left the world behind. We left the dukkha that's part of the world behind so that we can develop the Dhamma here. The Buddha is describing the exact same thing. Dukkha is described by the Buddha as, now this monk's is a noble truth of dukkha. Birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, death is dukkha, sorrow, regret, pain, grief, and despair are dukkha. Association with the unbeloved is dukkha. Separation from the loved is dukkha. Not getting what is wanted is dukkha. In short, the five clinging aggregates are dukkha. One of the nuns came down earlier today, and she looked at these, and she started getting interested, and she asked me to explain it. And we talked about this, and she kind of got it. We got over to here, and she saw five clinging aggregates. She said, "I don't know, five clinging aggregates. How can you explain that? I don't understand that." I said, "Well, the five clinging aggregates simply describe the personal experience of suffering." And her eyes lit up a little bit. I'm not sure she quite got it, but that's really the best description. If you read it, if you take it in the context of what the Buddha just said, he's describing suffering, and then he says, in short, the five clinging aggregates are dukkha. Form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and consciousness is our experience, our personal experience of dukkha, and that's just the label that's put on it. And again, we're going to develop that a little bit more as we go along in different contexts. The Nagara Sutta. The Buddha was at Savatthi in Jita's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. There he addressed those gathered. Friends, you're going to hear us again. Friends, before my awakening, when I was only an unawakened bodhisattva, I came to the realization of the difficulties of the world. The world is born, it ages, it dies, it falls away and returns. But there is no understanding of the ending of stress and suffering. No ending of the aging of stress and suffering of aging and death. When will the world understand the cessation of the stress and the suffering from aging and rebirth? Now again, he's not talking so much about reincarnation as giving birth to more moments that are subject to stress and suffering. Then I had the thought, what initiates aging and death? What is the requisite condition that aging and death are dependent on for arising? He's talking about dependent origination here. From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. From birth as the requisite condition comes aging and death. Now again, remember the context. He's talking about the world. He's not necessarily talking about physical birth, although he is, but it's not just in that context. Giving birth to another ignorant moment is setting that whole chain of events. From ignorance comes mental fabrications. We're setting in what is going to cause suffering now. What causes it? What's the origination of it? The birth of ignorance. Then I had the thought, what initiates birth? What is the requisite condition that birth is dependent on for arising? From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. From becoming ignorant as the requisite condition comes birth. So of course he's not talking about physical birth. He's talking about giving birth to the subject matter, to the context, giving birth to suffering, rooted in ignorance. In most of the translations, becoming ignorant is written only as becoming. And of course, that's very common. It's one of the most confusing things of this. In almost every translation I've ever read, after becoming is nothing. And it's left kind of up to your imagination. It always confused me. Why is that? Because they're avoiding ignorance. Becoming ignorant is what sets this whole chain of dependencies in motion leading to suffering.
Now, I've never understood the where he at one point uses becoming and then at another point he uses birth. And to me it's like, why is he making a distinction? Why are these two things in different places?
And so he's describing in an overall sense the ongoing process of becoming awakened or the ongoing process of continually to become ignorant. Hence the name of the book, Becoming Buddha.
The final few minutes of this talk and discussion were not recorded. My apologies.